So it's Rainforest Mind with me, Casper Thompson. I'm always slightly self-conscious during these intros and during the outros that I record. I suddenly have a sense of speaking to an audience of infinite possibilities. Who are you? I've some idea, but on the other hand, I've no idea at all. Today I'm speaking to Alison Priestman about embodied eco-spirituality. That's a phrase I coined in response to some conversations that I'd already had with Alison. Alison is my supervisor for my therapy practice, so I see her once every couple of weeks or so to talk about my client work. She's also a trainer on the embodied relational therapy course that I'm just finishing, and on the wild therapy course as well. So today we talked about spirituality coming from the body or being alive in the body, spirituality in relation to wildness, spirituality as something that emerges out of relationship with other living beings, with the natural world, with the whole universe. Now, I asked Alison where she wanted to start the conversation, and she said maybe by using this term that I'd coined as a springboard. So embodied eco-spirituality.
Yes, I really like that title, Casper. And it came from you rather than me, but I quite like it. Because it feels like the start. So the starting place for me is through my body, through dropping into myself and really feeling my body and being very sense-based. And that allows an expansion. So it's the opposite of a transcendence. So for me, spirit comes through my body and through relationship with people and animals and plants other than human, more than human.
Yeah. So when you drop into your body, can you say more about what that's like?
I think it's a good resource place for me because I've been a body therapist for some time, 18 years or something then. And even before that, I did a lot of dance and meditation or whatever. So it's very honed in me to be inside my body. And it feels quite a comfortable place most of the time if I'm not ill. And resource, so following my breath. And actually quite often sitting in my pelvis and my root chakra. So feeling quite grounded and quite comfortable.
And you said there's an expansion or something about being in the body that connects you to other beings and to the world.
Well, if I'm in my body, then I'm here now. I'm in the present. I'm not drifting off with my 100 million exciting thoughts about what I might want to write about therapy or, distraction. It feels like they're distractions. And that there's a, if I'm in my body, I'm much more alive, awake. So an active meditation state of being here, being present. And it's expansive because just being in my head is quite a small place, really.
Sure.
Yeah, for one thing, my body is physically bigger. And then I'm able to go out into the world. I see things. I can smell things more, touch them.
So there's a sense of... I had a question which is something like, what are you waking up to? And it sounds like partly what you're waking up to is what's around you.
Yes. I think I'm waking up to my own vitality, that I am alive, that I have got a body, I have got breath, and I experience things. So I'm waking up to my feelings. And I'm waking up to my contact with myself and then everything else, you know, whether it's the computer screen, whether it's my lovely fern behind me in the corner, or this morning I went outside and had a wild therapy session with a client, which was just delightful just to be outside. It was very frosty, so lots of clothes, but beautiful because the sun came out and started melting and something unfolded that felt right and useful and appropriate. And it's just amazing to be able to see the trees. And I feel like my breathing drops deeper. I expand, I relax.
When you use the word alive, it makes me think of a story that has really stayed with me since I read it a few weeks ago, and it's from Gerald May's book Wilderness, which I mentioned to you before, and it's an experience he has. The whole book is about him being called to the mountain and experiencing this calling and experience what he describes as a presence, and also about aliveness. And the experience I'm thinking of is his first night camping in the mountain on his own. He wakes up in the night and a bear is walking through the campsite.
Gosh.
And he feels full of fear, but complete. He says, there's nothing else in me but fear. And in the next day, he's grateful for that, for being alive, and that the bear didn't cause any, you know, didn't eat him. But he's also grateful for the experience of being completely full of fear. And there were, it sounds like there was something completely right about that moment. And somehow, in what you're saying, I'm hearing some echo in what he described of that moment.
Yeah. It makes me, that story very much also says about, it's also dangerous being alive. I mean, he was in potentially in danger anyway, but maybe he was in less danger because he was really alert and alive and present in himself. He might have done something bonkers and attracted more attention if he wasn't. But, you know, life is dangerous. It's it's unpredictable and scary. And I think spirituality for me is really important because it gives me a thread of holding and hope in what is often a difficult world that we live in.
Yeah. You know,
and I have a lot of grief about different enormous problems, you know, different poverty across the globe, but also destruction of our environment. And that latest report, I've forgotten who did the latest report, but saying something crazy like we've got 11 years or we're completely, 11 years to stick below 2% increase or 1.5% increase on climate change. And it's very scary. I mean, I've kind of known that for a long time in the sense that, yeah, it's enormous what we're all facing, and maybe we're a bit fucked in a way.
Sure. And what is the, in the face of that, and in the face of the story that came out yesterday about, you know, losing, we've lost, that's not what, is it? Human beings have destroyed 60% of the world's animals.
Yeah.
In the
That's
face
very
of those kind of, yeah, those kind of pains, really, what is the hope for you? You said spirituality gives you some
hope. Yeah, I think it's very hard to put into words, and I think that's right, because these things are much bigger than us. But I also think that words are incredibly important, and that's why I kind of was quite excited when you said, oh, should we talk about this? Because the words are important, because that grounds something. So something about the words are, I feel that there's something much bigger than myself that is an unfolding of a process in a healthy, helpful direction. That there is, and I don't know what word to call it. People have used God in the past, and I'm sort of wary about that, but I do believe there is some big wisdom out there.
My Buddhist teacher used the phrase benign process in the past, which I quite like.
Benign process is lovely, yeah. And benign is interesting because it's not saying that's not even saying that it's necessarily helpful or growthful, but it's benign. It's kind of, well, what are your associations with benign?
Well, mine actually, I suppose, are from the, you know, the place I most hear that word is when people are talking about medical tests and biopsies and,
okay,
oh, it's benign. It's not, it's harmless.
It's harmless. Okay.
Harm. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I have
this. My teacher said there was a sense for me of something beyond, you know, more than harmless, that there was something caring implied. But you're right, when you ask me about the word benign, that isn't my first association.
but not harmful anyway. A sort of neutral and sometimes benign process, as it were, can in the short term feel painful or harmful or difficult. But I think in the long term, there is a collective holding, a collective wisdom. And when you call this my spirituality embodied eco-spirituality, the eco bit feels really important because there's some really wonderful ideas around coming from eco-psychology about systems theory. And again, my words stumble, but it's something like we are complex organisms, a complex network, living within complex networks. And that very complexity holds us and organizes us.
And when I think of complexity, I think of Nick saying in Wild Therapy that a complex system tends towards a more efficient relationship with the complex systems around it, that ultimately there is a movement towards better relating that just comes out of the nature of what it means to be a complex system, that there's this sort of negotiation happening all the time.
Yes, negotiation's a nice word, isn't it? And also I think what's really important when you bring Nick Totten's Wealth Therapy book in, it's something like he's talking about that we need to get out of the way, and human beings have an incredible arrogance, whereas the complexity has its own wisdom or rightness within it, and often we disturb and distort, and often what we need to do is just be more spacious and step back and allow.
There's also something in what you're saying that makes me think about conscious and unconscious process somehow, that there's a wisdom in the unconscious process.
Yes, yeah.
Actually, that the consciousness can cut through that and cut across it and in a sort of defensive agenda.
Yeah. And if we're talking about Nick Totten, he had a lovely metaphor, which was to talk about consciousness is like a clearing. And maybe it's a clearing in a forest or a jungle. So we're aware of a certain bit, and that's this clearing. And it may be 6 foot wide, and it may be, I don't know, like a mile wide or something. But we just have this space. But the space is held by the diversity and the complexity and the animals and the plants that are beyond the clearing.
So it sounds like in what you're saying, there's an invitation to trust something beyond our usual way of thinking or getting in the way of ourselves.
Yeah. And also that we don't have to do it all. Maybe we can relax a little bit into that. Oh, we're just in the clearing and the forest. It might have bears in the forest and they might terrify us, but maybe it's benign. Maybe we're held.
Yeah.
We don't have to work everything out.
And there's something about being terrified, which is included in that complexity. It isn't something to be afraid of or to avoid necessarily if it's emerging from the jungle.
Yeah, well, it sounds like it's the right response.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So there's also something here about, you know, traditional religion, maybe rather than spirituality, or what Richard Rohr calls churchianity. That's quite a nice phrase.
Churchianity,
yeah. It's about comparing, you know, making sure you've got your Sunday best on, and are you keeping more rules than your neighbour is, and so on. There's a lot of good dividing the world into good actions and bad actions, and good, wholesome, unwholesome, and what you're talking about doesn't seem to have that flavour to it.
Because we don't know where an action will go. I do believe in, I really believe in integrity, and that we need to, I want to always operate from generosity and aim to be as loving as I can be. So I think I have very strong ethics, and I think I really want to support ethics out in the world. So there's a lot about faith or religion, whatever your word is, churchosity.
Churchianity,
I suppose, is something different from
having religion
in a way, because you're talking about it being dogmatic, aren't you?
Yeah, which isn't the best kind of religion, and there are places that practice the best kind of religion.
Yeah.
And I here, I hope, for example,
in your temple.
Yeah, that we're towards that end of the scale.
Yeah.
So that there's something important about integrity and wholeheartedness and being kind.
Yeah.
And yeah. Supporting other people to do that somehow.
Supporting other people to do that. And also getting really behind ourselves to not do that from a rigid place.
Hmm.
Like, how can we show ourselves compassion for our own habits? And, you know, a lot of us can be entrained to be good girls and boys.
Yeah. Yeah, and I have had that experience, and it's been really interesting to me. Well, I'm still in the process of trying to separate out moralism, if you like, doing the right thing because of some fear-driven motive. I'm going to get told off or caught out.
Yeah.
And authenticity and aliveness, and can ethics spring from a place of aliveness? Yeah. There's something that feels potentially more dangerous about that to me, because when I'm being really alive, I've also got access to all of these other energies that aren't necessarily at first glance kind or loving.
Yeah. I was listening to your podcast this morning on wildness, because I thought, well, that has so many links in with what I hope we're going to be talking about. And you were saying something about rewilding, you said cultivating your wildness, and then you said no, cultivating is the wrong word. I think my word would be supporting, but it's something about really acknowledging your own and other people's wildness, and how we get what we've been talking about is our own domestication, isn't it? How we've been entrained to be good girls and boys, that's one way that we're domesticated, being good. And I really like what you were saying about wildness, about supporting your spontaneity and creativity and openness, aliveness.
And it's interesting, isn't it? Because domesticity is smaller than wildness. And yet in most of our lives, we treat it as if it's the other way around in terms of our own psychology, and in terms of in the world. You know, there is a place for domestic thinking, but it should be one thing among many things. It's the it's the clearing, isn't it? And the forest is much bigger than the clearing.
But I suppose what's disheartening for me, and on a planetary scale, the domestic is getting too big, and that's why we're killing off so many creatures. You know, going back to your 60% of animal loss.
And it's appealing. Domesticity is appealing. You know, I sit inside my warm flat looking at these huge panes of glass to the cold world outside, thinking, well, I'm doing a lot of thinking and talking about wildness, and I'm sitting on this side of the glass while I'm doing that, rather than going into the cold, damp garden or the up onto the hills.
Well, glass and warmth are important, I think.
Yeah, exactly. There's a place for that, but the scales have tipped somehow. So I wonder if I can ground us in a real example of, so maybe if it's possible for you to think of a time where you felt particularly wild or connected to your sense of spirituality. Or I know that you mentioned the work with the horses when we were in our conversation before this one.
I could talk about the horses. I'm not sure I felt grounded in my wildness, though I did get quite scared. Maybe I'll talk about that first, and then I could talk about other
things. Great.
It was during a wild therapy session with a client, actually, and I work outside. I live just outside of Stroud in the Cotswolds, so there's lots of common land. It's kind of like a 2-minute walk up my lane, so it's lovely to go out there. And there are there's graziers, and there's, I don't know, about 500 cows out there, and the cows are usually pretty mellow and gentle and delightful. And there's also, I think, five very big horses. So there's a herd of five horses with a donkey, and they're very big, kind of mongrel shire horses, if you like. Piebald, black and white. And I've always been a bit wary of horses. I'm not quite sure why, but I kind of keep my distance. And I was sitting on a bench with the client, and she was talking in depth, you know, about something. And we'd been observing the four horses below us. And what was fascinating for me is they were very much in their experience of each other. And they were very intently with each other. They're not necessarily looking at each other, and they'd move. So sometimes they'd all face outwards, and sometimes they'd all face inwards. And I was very struck by this internal communication. They were such, they were a herd.
Yeah.
And they all stood in this amazing way where they crossed their back legs over each other, almost like they were curtsying. I've never seen that before. And that was lovely and quite safe because they were like, you know, at least 50 foot away. And then I kind of heard something. I turned round, and the fifth member of the herd was approaching us from behind. I thought, oh no. And immediately quite a lot of fear came up for me. And this difficult thing like, ooh, so I'm supposed to being a therapist here and facilitating it for my client.
Yeah.
And I don't want to just play into my fear and ruin something that might be unfolding for her. I also wanted to keep it safe enough for both of us.
Yeah.
And so I just sat there really and just tried to be with my fear. And the horse came closer and closer. And because we were sitting down, it was quite big above us. And I'm having a real internal tussle. And so I turned to my...
It sounds like even now as you're telling me the story, I can see you sort of...
I'm still fearful, yeah. So I turned to my client and I said, oh, how are you with horses? I'm a bit nervous of them. And my client says, oh, a bit nervous too, but it's all right. There's some near where I live, so maybe it's okay. And I stay sitting for as long as I can, and the horse brings its head pretty close to me. And I thought, what's it going to do? Is it going to push us over? And so I stand up in the end, and the client strokes the horse and is quite affectionate and quite close. And it feels as if the horse has got very gentle energy. That it just literally wants to make contact. Then we moved away from the horse and we stood back, maybe 50 foot back, and looked at the horse. And the horse stayed in that spot above the bench and looked down at the herd, but didn't join the herd. And there was something about its body posture that had a lot of meaning for my client. And it did this amazing crossing its back leg like a curtsy, like the other horses.
Yeah.
So it was separate but with.
And
so what unfolded was something very profound for my client, I think, but something also very profound for me, which was about facing my own fear, but also just meeting this benign, you know, very benign presence of this horse. I actually seemed quite sort of sad or lonely, and maybe it just wanted to make contact with us.
Yeah.
And what it raised for me is, well, who's this therapy for? You know, who's holding who?
Sure.
And just how, you know, how beautiful sometimes things are if you allow them to unfold. I mean, if we'd said, if we stayed sat on the bench and I hadn't sat up, something else would have unfolded. You know, and I don't think I could have quite held that. I didn't want to get too kind of dysregulated. I would have gone into client mode, I think, if I'd stayed much longer.
Wild equine therapy.
Wild equine therapy, yeah.
So there's also something in there, isn't there, about, well, first of all, it's very relational because you do something in response to the horse. You're not just done to. You actually, okay, I'm going to stand up and change the relationship. But there's also something in there about trusting your experience of the horse. It sounds like in the beginning is this is something that's potentially dangerous, but I'm going to trust something that is, that there is something that is beyond danger. Would you, something like that?
I guess I sort of glimpse the potential.
Hmm.
And I think the other thing is, part of me thinks, well, I just need to open my eyes, actually. And
Hmm.
you can see. I always sort of joke that I don't speak horse language. I know people that do. But, even I, without speaking horse language, can just observe,
Yeah.
how quickly is this animal moving? How is it breathing? All the kind of things that I do with a client, in a way, as a body psychotherapist. Just slow down, be present, try and get out of the way to, well, what is going on? And it was bringing such gentle energy to us that, yeah, and trusting that my own story around my fears are not the only story around.
There's also something important for me in that story about the fact that it wasn't from you, that intervention. You didn't create it. It wasn't, it didn't directly come out of the client's material, whatever that was. It came out of another living being, out of the world, something emerging to meet you. That was how the that was what facilitated the change. And that feels, for me, that feels important. But it isn't something we create.
And I suppose it's also about the com it's also for me something about complexity in action. Like the
Yeah.
horse was just doing its own thing in its own system, and we were doing our thing in our system, and they come together and something right or important unfolded.
And I've got that quote in mind that I've mentioned to you before, I think from C.S. Lewis, that God, remember, God is wild. There's something about that in all of what we've been talking about, but particularly in this encounter somehow.
So it's God is the lion, Aslan, in
In
CS
the novels, that's right,
in the
yeah.
novel. Ah, oh,
But he
okay.
wrote a lot of non-fiction.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
Because I know in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, there's this, it's not a tame lion.
That's right. Yeah. So this isn't a piece of non-fiction writing. He wrote a lot of theology, and it's something like, remember, God is wild.
I think we've completely forgotten that, as
Yeah.
humans have really forgotten that.
Yeah. I think that's
Find
right.
that, find that, find that a really touching idea, actually.
And there is something expansive about that, isn't there? This isn't God as the, this isn't Christ the shepherd. It's much bigger than that.
Well, it's also quite. I'm still with God as a lion as well,
Yeah.
but God is wild. There's a ferocity there as well. There's storms and there's
And there's
destruction.
also, there's relating, isn't there? There's relating to something that is real, that isn't just a passive, oh, I'll receive you. It's actually, I've got, wildness has its own experience as well. It has its own movements. It's sometimes you lean into me and I might be a storm, some mo and maybe most of the time you lean into me and I'm a, I'm clear skies and sunshine, but occasionally that isn't the case.
I like
Rowan
that idea.
Williams said, I was reading, I've just started reading something by Rowan Williams from years ago, and he says, sometimes God will precipitate a crisis in order to teach us that we can't rely on law, which is essentially perhaps what we were saying about moralism before, and that we can't rely on our own working of things out or trying to manipulate results. Yeah, that it isn't just, God isn't just the, there's a quote from a Buddhist teacher, and he says something like, the Buddhist, I think it's might be Aitken Roshi, he said the Zen teacher's job is to pull the rug from under the disciples' feet and to help them get back up again. And I, in response to that, you just say, well, life does plenty of rug pulling, but there is something about what we're talking about, where both of the, spirituality, God, what wildness plays both of those functions at different times. It pulls the rug from under our feet and it supports us to find a way of standing again. So you said you might be able to speak about another example of when maybe when you felt particularly wild or connected to your sense of spirituality.
I've been kind of thinking about that the last week or so, and what I realise is I've got lots of small examples, and for me it's in the small, I think. And maybe the past year, but certainly like the past 10 months, I've really actively tried to develop a practice of going out onto the common on my own, every few days. And sometimes I walk, and quite often I go and find somewhere to sit. And mostly I just, and sometimes I run, I go out there to just to be and see what will unfold. And I think what feels important to me is the dropping down and the relaxation and feeling more embodied, but also this sense of feeling so much more at home. And like, I really like just sort of sitting and being and almost like crawling into small spaces, or just my body sitting on the ground and looking at plants and immersing. And yeah, this feeling of home and less separation or something. Like, because previously most of my contact with being outside, I'd garden, I do a lot of gardening, and that's wonderful, but I'm usually digging a plant up and moving it around or chopping its head off or something. It's quite interventionist and controlling. It's not a relaxed way of being. I'll stop and listen to the buzzards and look at the robin and thing, but I'm very active and very purposeful. I'm changing things the whole time. And it feels like that the relationship where I go out and I'm just being is very different. I haven't got an agenda. It's much more accepting, less controlling, and I lose myself more, saying there's more immersion, more. I don't, the words go again, but something
Maybe
very.
the glade in the forest gets smaller somehow, or maybe even disappears sometimes.
Maybe I just. I'm climbing amongst the roots of the tree and looking up. Not in the clearing anymore. That's a nice analogy. And I feel touched. Something touches me each time, and it's small. And that feeds me. It doesn't have to be big. But I go out and I touch and I am touched, and that ongoingly is very nurturing.
And do you think the small things for you are a window into the big things, that there's a sense of, the universe in a grain of sand, or is it actually simply that the foxglove is enough? Or maybe both those things are true.
I'm not sure what you're asking me. Did you say foxglove is enough? I'd say the foxglove is enough.
Well, I think, I'm thinking of, is it Blake who talks about the universe in a grain of sand? That idea that also, as well as the foxglove being enough on its own, it also somehow speaks to, or is a window to, the whole of everything.
I know I feel held, and the question you were asking me earlier, something about what's spirituality offering me to help with the big difficulties in the world, it's this active holding. And when I go out on my own on the common, it feels strong, it feels something loving. It's not just benign. Those experiences are usually, I haven't yet gone out in the snow or pouring rain,
But
but you,
that's
sorry.
the, sorry, I was just, that there is a sort of, I really resonate with that idea of being received and held and experiencing being loved by the natural world, or experiencing something loving about that. And you say, when you say, I haven't gone out into the snow, I'm like, oh, Maybe it's there as well, even when we're freezing out.
I think so, yeah.
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 Harder to find, maybe, when, sometimes, but yeah.
I know Stephen Tame, who did a podcast with you recently, who I work a lot with, and he says something about, we just need to put enough clothes on. It's
Yeah, sure.
simple.
Yeah.
Don't be afraid of rain.
No, and I'm also thinking about there's lots of stories from the Victorian times of these wild children who were brought up, who perhaps ran away from home and were brought up by animals or brought up by the forests. But apparently there's one account that has been corroborated. There's actually a journal article or a diary by a doctor that speaks to this child who was and he was recovered from the wilderness and put in, a starched collar and sort of didn't, had this very uncomfortable experience of being domesticated. And when it snowed, he ran out of this domestic environment, stripped off all his clothes and played in the snow and didn't get cold. And there was some sense that actually his body, because he'd lived naked in the wilderness for so long, his body wasn't troubled by the weather in the way that mine would be. So yeah, I would have to put on a lot of clothes to go and do that, but maybe at some point that wasn't necessary.
Makes me think of indigenous cultures when you talk about the boy who was nurtured by the forest, and it's easy to idealize indigenous cultures, but I think that there is a lot of wisdom within indigenous cultures, and it's where we've evolved from as hunter-gatherers. And I know on that wildness podcast you did, you talked about agriculture and how Nick Totten's written about the role of agriculture as separating us off from a much more reciprocal relationship with nature and the earth.
And in Jay, is it
Jay
Jay
Griffiths.
Griffiths's? Yeah, in her book, just that the one thing that stood out for me was how she talked about the sort of treatment of discontent teenagers or teenagers that were perhaps going into addiction, or the thing that worked was the elders of the community taking them back out onto the land. That was the thing that healed the wounds that led to that misbehavior. And that's what, there's something there about, you talk about going out into the common. That's the same thing, isn't it?
I think psychotherapy, in a lot of its theories and practice has become is too human focused. And that's why I think the eco-psychology movement has got a really important role to rebalance something that we've, and there's a lot of emphasis within psychotherapy on attachment theory, which has its value, but I think it's also limited because it's really not thought about enough, our attachment with the other than human and more than human, because that is the bigger holding of our life. It's what feeds us, it's what breathes us, it is our home. And some traditions would talk about it being our mother or father. And I think in a very real way the world is, but we forget that. And I do think that a lot of our cultural problems are massively because of the severance, the disconnect.
So I sort of feel like we've covered a lot of ground already this morning. One of the big themes that we've talked about is this idea, right at the beginning you said spirituality isn't something that's transcendent, it's something that's in the world. And I've got a real sense of that. It's about meeting the world as a living thing and the universe as a living thing. And that actually that wildness of the universe is what offers the holding and the support and the love that allows you to then come from a place of integrity. Maybe
That's a
that's a nice place to
yeah,
finish.
maybe that is.
Any last thoughts
Loads.
for
I can
now?
wait for another day. Thank you. It was good talking.
Yeah, thank you very much. Really appreciated this conversation. So my thanks to Alison Priestman again for joining me for today's edition of Rainforest Mind. Do remember to subscribe on iTunes or your podcast player. Drop me a comment through social media or on the website, and I'll be with you next time for another edition of Rainforest Mind.